There was an article in the Lansing State Journal a few days ago. It's amazing how many people have gotten upset over the fact that the millennium shouldn't really have started a couple of weeks ago, but should be starting 50 weeks from now, next year, 2001, when, of course, you know, we know, and it's fairly common knowledge, you can look in any encyclopedia and it'll tell you, that the year 2000 is purely arbitrary anyway, because it's not exactly 2,000 years since Christ was born. So this year is not 2001, so to speak. It's not even 2,000. We don't know what it is. So why does everybody get upset about this? But people do. Anyway, and one thing that people got upset about was the fact that this year is a leap year. And normally, years ending in 00 are not leap years. So 1900 was not a leap year. 1800 was not a leap year. 1700 wasn't. 1600 wasn't. But 1500 was. Because once every 500 years, remember this next time it comes around, once every 500 years, there isn't a leap year when the year ends in 00. Apparently that does enable us to, you know, keep track more exactly of how long it takes the Earth to go around the Sun. Of course, some think the Sun goes around the Earth, but anyway, that's another issue that is constantly debated by people. You know, they do have a flat Earth society. Having flown around the world, I'm not too inclined to join it, but they do have people who still believe the Earth is flat. Anyway, this was a debate that went on, but in the paper, finally somebody settled the debate by pointing out that the person that we should blame for all of this was the Pope, because it was Pope Gregory in the 1500s who decided that the calendar was wrong. Gradually, the Earth was getting more and more out of sync, and basically they were starting to experience spring and winter and autumn in the summer and so on. So they had to do something about it, because the number of days in the year and the way the calendar was calculated was not working exactly. So he made a decision to simply abolish 10 or 11 days, I think it was 10 days, as a result of which now the Orthodox churches, of course, still keep the old calendar, so their Christmas is, you know, a number of days after the Christmas that the Western world observes theirs. But he basically settled it, and when it was pointed out that there was still a discrepancy, he made the arbitrary decision that once every 500 years there would be a leap year at the end of the century, whereas there wouldn't be during the other times that the century turned. So that explains it all. But it also helps illustrate just how powerful an influence the papacy has been throughout history. It is hard, I think, for us today, especially living in a country like the United States, where church and state have been separated for so long. It's perhaps a bit easier for me to understand, because church and state are not separated in England, where I grew up. But it is hard, I think, for us to understand, living in nations with religious freedom, just how powerful an influence the church has been, and what a major political force it has been for most of the last 2,000 years, and even today still is in some countries. Politics and religion have been interrelated. I find it interesting, as I was preparing this this sermon and also an article for World News and Prophecy, it struck me that in Western European countries, where church and state usually are still not separated, in England the official state church is the Church of England, and you've got in a number of European countries, Sweden, Norway, Finland and so on, the Lutheran church is the state church. In Holland, the Dutch Reformed Church is the state church, and in Spain and Portugal, the Catholic Church is. So you've got an official relationship between church and state in many Western European countries. I found it interesting that in those nations, there is very little religious observance, and religious groups do not get involved in politics. In countries like the United States, where there has been this separation of church and state, we have a tendency amongst religious people to get involved in politics, the religious right, for example. And not just the United States, but in the countries of Eastern Europe, which have been communist for 50 years. Communism, of course, was atheistic, and the church was suppressed. Now suddenly we find the people, again, getting involved, religious people getting involved politically, and politics and religion, you know, coming up against each other, or even working together in certain cases. So it's interesting to me that that is taking place. Sometimes the mix of politics and religion is deadly, with negative consequences to millions of people. An example of this was during the two world wars of the last century, the 20th century. Today we're going to take a closer look at the role of the church in those two world wars, and in particular in the Second World War. When most people think of the Roman Catholic Church, they think of a church. What is often overlooked, is that it's also a country. Now, it's hard, again, for us to always focus on something like that, living in Michigan, but I remember when we lived in Ghana, in West Africa, we lived in the capital city of Accra. And in one of the houses that we lived in, almost 20 years ago now, when we used to take the children for a walk, we would always pass the Vatican Embassy. The name on the plaque outside was Embassy of the Holy See. And that was the official name. And you had the Vatican flag flying outside with the keys to the kingdom on the flag. The papal nuncio, or ambassador, was dressed in all his clerical garb. What was particularly interesting was that because he had been the ambassador to Ghana longer than any other ambassador to that country, he was actually the senior ambassador. So when it came to any diplomatic activity, he was always the first one to be invited, to be present at any official function that was going on that the Ghanaian government was holding. Now, I don't know whether that's normal. I would suspect that it probably is, that the papal nuncio in most countries is the senior diplomat. You're nodding your head. Well, I think there might be a reason for it, too, when you think about it. You see, when the United States sends people as ambassadors to other countries, usually they take their wife and their children along, too, if they have any. Sometimes they're a bit older. They've had more experience, so the kids might have left home. But usually they're only there for 2 or 3 years, and then they come back, or they go to another country. Most countries operate on a similar basis. But when you're dealing with Vatican clerics, they're not married, they don't have children. So therefore, the need to move them around for family reasons is not as great, you see. So the papal nuncio, the papal ambassador to a country, can more easily stay there longer. Also, it's just one individual. So, you know, again, it's easier to do that. He can stay there longer, and therefore, simply by default, because he's there the longest, he ends up being the senior ambassador of all the ambassadors to a nation. But the Vatican is a country. It is not just a church. There is no other situation on the face of the earth like it. There is no other church that is a nation, that is a political power on the face of the earth. Now today, the Vatican as a country is only 1 square mile. You go to the Vatican in Rome, and it is just 1 square mile. Now the Vatican has other properties around the city of Rome, which are also considered a territory of the Vatican State. And the Roman police have no authority over any of those properties, nor do they have any authority in the Vatican City itself. So if you commit a crime in Rome, for example, and you manage to run fast enough through Rome streets, which isn't difficult because the traffic usually is congested, you manage to run fast enough through the streets, you get into the Vatican City, you're okay, because you're away from the Roman police. It is a separate country. It has its own stamps, has its own flag, has its own king, the Pope, who is an autocrat. It's one of the last autocratic monarchies on the face of the earth, where the head of state has absolute power in the Vatican. It has its own ambassadors, its own secretary of state. The secretary of state is an extremely powerful individual, and often the secretary of state becomes the next pope because his position is so senior in the Vatican hierarchy. But always keep in mind, it is a country. It is not just a church. When we look at the book of Revelation, we see something interesting. In the book of Revelation, we see this history of this false religious system set against the true religion of God's true people, those who keep the commandments, as against this false religion, which is a descendant, really, of the pagan religions of the ancient world, Babylon the Great, as it's described here. It says this, "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters.'" Now, a woman is used in the scriptures symbolically often to describe a church. You see that even in the message to the seven churches, for example, where it refers to that woman Jezebel, for example. You know, and it's talking about a church. And here it symbolizes a church as well, the great harlot, a woman then, a church that sells itself for money, for favors. It's very interested in money and the accumulation of wealth. That sits on many waters, countless multitudes of people around the world, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. So inappropriate relationships have been conducted between this church and the political leaders of the world. Fornication is an inappropriate, it is an unbiblical, it is a wrong relationship, something which is not sanctioned by God. And here is a church that has committed fornication with the kings, prime ministers, presidents of the earth. And the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So a significant number of people, the inhabitants of the earth, have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Now when people are drunk, they are not thinking straight. So these people are just not thinking straight. They've been deceived by this false religion, and they're in a kind of a drunken stupor. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. A reference to the political resurrections, political religious resurrections, the church-state unions that would take place during the period since the time of Jesus Christ, first coming, right up until the second coming. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, the colors of wealth, also scarlet, the color associated with prostitutes, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, a fabulously wealthy church this, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. Now, in case you're not clear here, God is not speaking very highly of this organization in this particular passage. On her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great. This is where the religion really comes from. This is where its beliefs go back to, Babylon the Great. Not just Babylon, there were other influences from the ancient world which were gradually absorbed into this religion as well. Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, because other churches have come out of her, and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman, the false church, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, and when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Because this church destroyed, persecuted the true church, right from the beginning, really, right in the 4th century, for example, when the church gained the supremacy in the Roman world, it turned on the true followers of Jesus Christ and had them killed. And when John saw this church, he says, I marveled with great amazement, just marveling that this church is so powerful, so influential, so globe-encircling, and let's face it, it has lasted longer than any other institution on the face of the earth. Now, some will disagree with that. The Japanese claim their imperial family goes back 2,500, 600 years, but you can't prove that absolutely. But the church does go back almost a full 2,000 years. And so it is an institution that has survived just about everything. And, when we see what's happening in the world, we can see that, if anything, it's on the ascendancy again. It's on the rise. Until Italy was united in the 1860s, the Pope ruled over a physical territory known as the Papal States, much bigger than the Vatican City. So a large part of what is now central Italy was actually ruled by the popes. It was their own territory, just like Michigan is a state. They had their own state, but it wasn't a state, it was a country. It actually was a full country, the Papal States. But when Garibaldi united the whole nation of Italy, the people turned against the church. This is something that was happening throughout Europe. It really started a couple of hundred years ago. After the American Revolution, some of the French who fought over here on the side of the United States went back to France and spread some of the American ideas, as a result of which they had their own revolution in France, and that revolution turned against the church. So the church kind of started losing out in different countries. In 1848, a lot of Catholic countries in Europe had revolutions, and the church suffered. Then in 1859 came the theory of evolution, Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, with the publication of the book The Origin of Species. And this undermined the control that the church had over people's minds, because a lot of people latched onto the theory of evolution as an alternative explanation of the world to what the church offered people. So the church was actually losing control of people's minds. It was already losing control of nations, as nations turned against the church, but now it was losing control of their minds too. So the church reacted in an interesting way. In 1870 came the decree of papal infallibility. The decree of papal infallibility, which declared that when the Pope stated something ex cathedra, it was from God.
and nobody could argue with it, nobody could disagree with it. This elevated the Pope considerably. Until about 1870, the Pope was simply the head of a state, and he had other people around him, advisors and helpers and others, and he was just one amongst all of these people. He was the top one, but the others all had their roles to play as well. But now suddenly the papacy was elevated to where what came out of the Pope's mouth was directly from God. Remember, one of the titles of the Pope is the Vicar of Christ, and the word vicar means in place of. So the Pope is there in place of Jesus Christ. He is Jesus Christ on earth, in effect, because Jesus Christ is not physically upon the earth. So whatever the Pope decides then is coming directly from Jesus Christ. That is the thinking there when it comes to the decree of papal infallibility. Now, it didn't change things overnight, but gradually the popes became much more powerful, and the church started to much more reflect each individual pope's style of doing things. So in fairly recent times, some of you who are older will remember some of these people. Pope John the 23rd, for example, who was pope from 1958 to 63, only 5 years, was a friendly, grandfatherly, pastoral pope, a chubby little guy, if you remember, and rather a friendly individual and highly respected. He called the Second Vatican Council together and started to liberalize the church. One of its decisions was to switch from the universal use of Latin and allow the Mass to be said in the vernacular, in English or French or German or whatever language people wanted to say the Mass in. And he started to reach out as well to other churches, Protestant churches, in the hope of some sort of reconciliation. John Paul II is similar to John the 23rd in some respects, the present pope. However, he's very conservative theologically. Again, he's highly respected. He is a pastoral pope. Some popes began life as priests, and they rose up to become, you know, cardinals, become bishops, archbishops, then cardinals, and then they become pope. So they have a kind of a pastoral approach to being pope. They see the need to serve the people. But then you have others who are what you might call career politicians. They stayed with the bureaucracy in Rome and worked their way up through the bureaucracy. So there's two different kinds of popes here that we're talking about. John Paul II is, again, a pastoral pope because he began life as a priest and he worked his way up through the theological side of the church as against the political side of the church. But John Paul II is very conservative, resistant to any changes in the church. So many of the changes that John the 23rd introduced have been reversed by John Paul II, who is the present pope. Now, the present pope has appointed so many conservative people to senior positions within the church that it's a given that the next pope will be just as conservative as John Paul II is. Perhaps even more so, depending on which part of the world he comes from or exactly who it is. One pope who was in between John the 23rd and John Paul II was Paul VI. Who was pope for 15 years from 63 to 78. He was a bureaucrat. He was not a pastoral pope. Not much happened during his time in office, but he is famous for one major decision, and that is that birth control is not something that Catholics should practice. And again, that decision was reflected as infallibility. It is from God, and therefore it is not something that people can argue with. Have a look here. There's some quotes here I want to read to you. Well, one thing is always to keep in mind when you look at the history of the church, that the church is less interested in the welfare of its own members and its own political power. That's something that comes out quite frequently when you read the history of the church. So let's have a look at this article I've got here on the decree of papal infallibility. I just want to read something to you here. Has anybody got the latest World News and Prophecy? Nobody's got it yet. Well, I've got an article in there on this subject, but what I'm giving you in the sermon is far more extensive. But I want to read this passage on the decree of papal infallibility. The Roman Catholic Church is a very conservative organization. Unlike any other church, it has sustained itself for almost 2,000 years, always actively involved in the world's politics, especially the politics of Europe. Church and state were inseparable. Right up into this century, the Habsburg emperors of Austria had the right to veto the choice of a pope. While the church taught its adherents the divine right of kings, the kings forced their people to be subject to the church in everything. The social order of Europe was built upon these two foundations. when that order came to an end in the 19th century, the church had to reinvent and reassert itself. At a time of increasing democracy in many nations, the church was more autocratic. Faced with a republican mob in the eternal city, Rome, Pius IX, who was crowned in 1846, quote, hurled denunciations against the outrageous treason of democracy and threatened prospective voters with excommunication. Any Catholic who voted in any democracy was threatened with excommunication as recently as 1846. The historic decree of papal infallibility, passed on July 18, 1870, by 433 bishops, with only two against. So, you know, pretty much a 100% approval rating, so to speak, reads as follows. The Roman pontiff, when he speaks ex cathedra, that is, when exercising the office of pastor and teacher of all Christians, because remember, no other Christians are recognized by the church. So in the church's view, Christianity and Catholicism are the same thing. There is no other form of Christianity, officially. When exercising the office of pastor and teacher of all Christians, he defines a doctrine concerning faith and morals to be held by the whole church through the divine assistance promised to him in St. Peter. It's possessed of that infallibility with which the divine Redeemer wished his church to be endowed. And therefore, such definitions of the Roman pontiff are irreformable of themselves, and not from the consent of the church. An additional decree proclaimed that the Pope had supreme jurisdiction over his bishops, individuals, and collectively. The Pope, in effect, was ultimately and unprecedentedly in charge. Absolute power. The Pope's will, God's will, was the expression that was very popular at the time. The Pope's will, God's will. There's no difference. Now remember, this is what millions of people still believe. One of Pacelli's successors, Pacelli is Pius XII, who was Pope during World War II, and we're going to talk about him a little bit later. One of Pacelli's successors, Paul VI, wrote in a private note to himself of the solitude that infallibility and the papal office resulted in. Now keep in mind, we look at this as outsiders, so we see things differently. But keep in mind, somebody who has been brought up within the system and has never known anything else, whether he was brought up through the priesthood, you know, becoming a bishop and then an archbishop, a cardinal, and so on to pope, or whether he came up through the political process to become pope, the person in the office believes that he is there as the vicar of Christ. He is there as Jesus Christ, in place of Christ. So therefore, whatever he decides is of God. Now, can you imagine what that must do to a person's mind? What that must do to a person's image of himself? And how it must make a person act when it comes to making decisions regarding certain things. This is what Paul VI wrote in his diary. I was solitary before becoming Pope, but now my solitariness becomes complete and awesome. Hence the dizziness, the vertigo, like a statue on a plinth. That's how I live now. Jesus also was alone on the cross. I should not seek outside help to absolve me from my duty. My duty is too plain. Decide. Assume every responsibility for guiding others, even when it seems illogical and perhaps absurd, and to suffer alone, me and God. The colloquy must be full and endless. That's what Paul VI wrote in his diary on becoming Pope. No doubt similar sentiments would be expressed by other popes. As the writer of the book Hitler's Pope, which deals with Pius XII, wrote, he says, the ideology of papal primacy, as we have known it within living memory, is an invention of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Now do you see how that might contribute to the fulfillment of Bible prophecy? Because the papacy as we know it today is something which wasn't even there before 1870. In fact, it really wasn't there until after 1929, because 1929 is when Mussolini signed an agreement with the Vatican, the Lateran Treaty. And that agreement gave the Vatican its own territory, that one square mile. One square mile is purely symbolic in a sense. It doesn't really mean anything in itself, but it does enable the Vatican to claim to be a country.
And because of that, it has been able to, you know, embark in a different direction, so to speak, since 1929. It was this deeply held conviction of absolutism and of the supreme role of the church in the affairs of this world that led to Pacelli's controversial actions in the Nazi era. Pius XII helped the Nazis come to power, and again, I'm going to come to that as we go through this sermon. To Pacelli, Pius XII, nothing was more important than the papacy. Even the lay members of the church were merely pawns in a great power game that was constantly being played out on the world stage. This becomes clear when reading of his role in both world wars. Again, to remind you, Revelation 17, verse 2, talks about the church with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. This has been the history of the church for the last 2,000 years. Just go back to that chapter for a moment. In verse 3, there's an interesting passage here. He carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. I wonder if we've ever thought of the symbolism of that particular passage there. What is the wilderness? Well, the wilderness is a place of drought where people can never be fed or watered, never satisfied. And in the same way, false religion does not satisfy. In verse 6, the greatest crime of the church is the persecution of God's true people, in verse 6. Which you can prove historically. Now in verse 7 it says, "The angel said to me, 'Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is.'" Now this can apply in two ways. Firstly, when the Roman Empire was destroyed in the 5th century, it seemed like it was finished. But then the church put it back together again. The church was the image of the empire. But secondly, the church even now seems like it's finished. And here is a chapter that talks about the time of the end, about the events surrounding the return of Jesus Christ. So a lot of people, and most people are bored with history, or most people don't even know much history and they're not interested. Most people just think, oh, well, that's all in the past. The church was, that was then, this is now. Things are different now. But this says the whole world will marvel when this institution again rises up. Those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life. So those who don't understand the truth, the prophecies as revealed in the scriptures, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. So this is talking about seven resurrections of the Roman Empire with the woman, the false church, sitting upon these political institutions that resurrect the empire. And it's not too easy to find them in history. There was an item on PBS's European Journal this week about one of them, for example. An exhibition has just been opened in the city of Ghent in Belgium on this particular individual because he was born there. And, you know, he is one of the people who tried to resurrect the Roman Empire, so they're not too difficult to locate. But if you look at each of the first five, we've always been able to see the connection between the church and the state. The first one was Justinian. In the 550s, right in the middle of the 6th century, Justinian managed to put the Roman Empire together again. Remember, Rome fell in 476. By 554, it had been put back together. Justinian came from the east, from Byzantium, the second Rome, and he reunited the Roman Empire, and he used the church to do it. So church and state were closely involved in this resurrected Roman Empire. It didn't last long, though. After he died, it kind of fizzled out. A couple of hundred years later, along came Charlemagne, Charles the Great, who was crowned by the Pope on Christmas Day in the year 800, and he reunited the Roman Empire with the church and state again. Then the third time, because Charlemagne's children kind of fell out and they didn't really accomplish all that much, the third time was in 962 when the Holy Roman Empire that Charlemagne had tried to start was put back together again by Otto the Great. And this was a union of all the countries that had been in the Roman Empire.
with the church playing a major role. It was supposed to be a holy Roman Empire. In fact, it was supposed to be the kingdom of God on earth, the 1,000-year millennial rule of Jesus Christ through his vicar, the Pope. That began in 962. And again, that wasn't all that effective after Otto himself died. Then in 1520, Charles V, the one who was born in Ghent in Belgium, took over the office of Holy Roman Emperor and again tried to unite the whole world, in fact. He tried to unite the whole world into one Catholic empire. He was the one who Martin Luther clashed with. Then the fifth one was Napoleon. Now, Charles V was crowned by the Pope. Napoleon was crowned by the Pope in 1804. So those first five resurrections, you see the church and the state heavily involved. The sixth one, it's always been much more difficult to show the church's involvement. In fact, really, we've never really been able to prove it until now. And that's the significance of this book, Hitler's Pope by John Cornwell, because we see just how heavily the church was involved in the sixth resurrection of the Roman Empire, which was the one that ended with the fall of Hitler and Mussolini in 1945. The church was involved in the politics of all the previous five. In Revelation 17, then, it says there are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. Now, it's an interesting phraseology, and we can only speculate exactly what it means. But when it talks about the five have fallen, keep in mind that those first five, where the church was heavily involved, people in most countries did not have access to the Bible. In fact, it's only really during the last one, Napoleon, the last of those five, that in the English-speaking countries, most of the wealthy people would have had Bibles. But even the ordinary people did not have Bibles because they didn't read. They couldn't read, even in the time of Napoleon. It's only really been since about 1870 that most people in Western nations have been educated in the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Of course, now many aren't. We're actually going into reverse now in terms of education. But from 1870 until fairly recently, most people did learn to read and write and do their sums, so to speak. And the Bible also, through mass production, became readily available to most people. Keep in mind also that the book of Revelation is about the events preceding the return of Jesus Christ. So it would appear that this is really written for our benefit. There are seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. The sixth one, in other words, coincided with this end time period. Now keep in mind that the sixth resurrection of the Roman Empire really began in 1870 and did not come to an end until 1945. So 75 years. And then it talks about a final one which has not yet come. And that is still the case. It has not yet come. But it's going to come again. Now, as I said before, that 1870 to 1945 period, it's often seemed, looking back, that the church was not involved. In 1870, Germany was united. Before 1870, Germany was actually 39 different countries. Go back another 100 years, it was 360 different countries, with a grand duke here and a prince there and a king there and somebody else somewhere else. But finally, in 1870 and 71, it was united by Chancellor Otto von Bismarck under the Kaisers. The Kaisers were the emperors that ruled Germany. Bismarck was the chancellor or the prime minister. And one of the first things Bismarck did when he took over the whole of Germany was pass anti-Catholic legislation, because he was a Lutheran. The Kaisers were Lutherans. And the Kaisers came from Prussia, which is a Lutheran part of Germany. And they wanted to restrict the power of the Catholic Church. So they passed anti-Catholic legislation at a time when France was trying to get the priests out of politics. Italy had just united and turned against the Church. So the Church was going through a pretty tough time, deservedly so, after some of the things it had done over the centuries. But it didn't seem like things were going very well for the Church. But by 1914... the church was bouncing back following the decree of papal infallibility. And by 1914, was heavily involved in politics again. And you see the church's involvement in politics contributed greatly to the First World War. Read any book on the First World War and you will not understand why on earth it happened. And let's understand the most important thing of the 20th century, the worst thing that happened in the 20th century was World War I, the First World War.
If that had never happened, almost every other problem in the 20th century would never have taken place, because we've never settled down again since World War I. World War I was supposedly started when the Austrian Archduke, Franz Ferdinand, was assassinated by Serbian nationalists. So Austria demanded that the Serbs do certain things. The Serbs complied with some of them, but then Austria attacked them anyway, and they went to war. So then the Russians, who liked the Serbs and were allies, declared war on Austria. So then the Germans declared war on Russia, and then the Germans invaded Belgium, so France declared war on Germany, and then Britain declared war on France on Germany and Austria, and, you know, the whole thing just went on then for over 4 years, and the whole world, as it had been for hundreds of years, was just destroyed. And we have never gotten over that in the last century. What was unknown until John Cornwell did this research on Pius XII was the involvement of the church. Now, before I tell you what happened, John Cornwell is a Catholic. He's a British Catholic writer, a historian, and he was upset that so many people of my parents' generation blamed the church for some of the things that happened in World War II. And he wanted to exonerate the Pope, Pius XII. And he got permission from the Vatican to spend time in their library, going through all the historical records, the archives, the official papers of Pius XII, not just when he was Pope, but even before he was Pope, when he was Cardinal Secretary of State, and even before that, when he worked in the Secretary of State's department. And rather than exonerate the Pope, it did exactly the opposite, because it showed that Pius XII was heavily involved, not only in the Nazis coming to power, but even before that, in the events that led up to World War I. It wasn't that Pius XII was a Nazi. It wasn't that he, you know, decided, I want the Germans to take over the whole world. It wasn't quite like that. It was just that in his obsession to put the church as a political institution first and to get what he wanted for the church, that he inadvertently contributed to these events that then plunged the world into the two worst conflicts in our entire history. In 1914, in the month leading up to World War I, Pacelli, Eugenio Pacelli, who is the man who later became Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli was involved in arranging a concordat, a treaty with Serbia, known as the Serbian Concordat. Now, Serbia, you all know where Serbia is. That's where Milosevic is now. So, you know, the problems still haven't been resolved almost 100 years later. But anyway, Serbia is an Orthodox country. And Serbia was a new country because it was ruled by the Turks for a long time, and it had just kind of got its independence. And there were quite a few Catholics there. And the Catholic Church wanted a concordat with the country of Serbia, which would enable them to have diplomatic relations, political influence, give the church certain rights. Now, before that, the Austrians had the responsibility of looking after the interests of the Catholics in Serbia. And so Pacelli was actually taking something away from Austria and giving it to Serbia at exactly a time when there was tension between Austria and Serbia. The result was the Concordat was signed. The Austrians were livid. Every newspaper in Vienna came out strongly critical of this decision that had been made. Just 4 days later, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was shot. And the hysteria just built up until we had World War I. But when you read the book, you see that it is quite likely that if Pacelli had not been arranging this agreement with the Serbs, World War I would have been avoided. And if World War I had been avoided, then World War II would have been avoided. We would never have had communism. We would never have had the Cold War. We would never have had Vietnam or Korea or Cuba. You know, we'd never have had all of these problems. But not the way it was to be. Let's have a look here and just get some of these quotes here that I've got to read to you. Yeah, I lost my... Okay. He writes here, the result was a sharp increase in anti-Serbian rhetoric and calls for action. When the Archduke was murdered in Sarajevo only days later, emotions were already volatile. The Serbian Concordat undoubtedly contributed to the uncompromising terms that the Austro-Hungarian Empire pressed on Serbia, making war inevitable. So it's a direct connection between the role of the church and the the events that led up to World War I. After the First World War, some time after, Pacelli was sent to Germany as papal nuncio. First he went to Munich, and then later on he was sent to Berlin. Actually, he was sent to Munich during the First World War, but later on to Berlin. And it's interesting the role he played there as well. Because after the First World War, after World War I, Germany became a democracy. The Weimar Republic, they called it. And it didn't last very long. It had high unemployment. There was a lot of internal chaos. All kinds of different things were happening. And Hitler, of course, was one of the people that was trying to gain the advantage, to get political power. And Hitler eventually, in early 1933, when there was an election, Hitler was able to get 37% of the votes. He was actually elected to office with his National Socialist Party. With 37% of the votes, he could not control the Reichstag, or the Parliament of Germany. The President of Germany, von Hindenburg, asked him to be Chancellor because he led the biggest single political party. But there was another political party that stood in his way of absolute power, and that was the Catholic Center Party, which was almost as big as the Nazi Party. And with some of the smaller parties, had a majority. Pacelli got involved and basically had the party, he betrayed the party so that Hitler got absolute power. Again, Pacelli wanted a concordat with Germany. He wanted a special relationship with Germany, a treaty with Germany between the Vatican as a country and Germany as a country. And this would enhance the powers of the Vatican as a state, as a country, its political influence. And in order to get this agreement with Hitler, there was a clause inserted that made it illegal for any Catholic to take part in politics in Germany. So as soon as Pacelli signed the agreement, the Catholic Church in Germany could not get involved in politics. And the Catholic Center Party had to disband immediately. And Hitler was able to round up anybody, any Roman Catholic, that opposed him because of this treaty with the Vatican that said that no Catholic could get involved in politics. So Hitler had absolute power, courtesy of the Vatican. And what is often not realized is that the Vatican was the first country in the world to recognize the odious Nazi regime. It became the first country to recognize it. And in all the time that Pacelli was Secretary of State, prior to becoming Pope in 1939, and then Pope from 1939 till 1958, in all that time, right up until Hitler's Third Reich collapsed, he never said a word against the Nazis or against the Third Reich. Nothing. Now, you remember in World War II, Germany and Italy were allied. Mussolini and Hitler were allied. And Rome, of course, was the capital city where the Vatican was. So here he is, in the Vatican, in the city of Rome, the heart of fascism, if you like, in Europe, one of the two main capitals of the Axis powers, the fascist powers. He never said a word against what they were doing. And when it became clear that the Jews were being persecuted as well, he didn't get involved in that either. Again, I want to read to you an extract from this article. Hitler's rise to power was not an easy one. His first forced attempt of power resulted in his imprisonment, during which he wrote his book, Mein Kampf, My Struggle. His National Socialist Party struggled on with minimal support as a small, bothersome party dwarfed by much bigger parties that held the reins of power. His opportunity for increased support came with the Depression, when millions of Germans lost their jobs and hyperinflation wiped out people's personal savings. Blaming the Jews and foreigners in general for causing this, Hitler's popularity rose, but he still could not command power without the support of others. Eventually, only the Catholic Center Party stood in his way to absolute power. Here, Pacelli was very helpful. Seeking a concordat between the Reich and the Vatican, Pacelli betrayed the millions of Catholic supporters of the Catholic Center Party by signing an agreement with Hitler that resulted in a ban on political activity by members of the Church. It was the only democratic party left in Germany. With its disbanding, Hitler became the supreme leader of the country. Nothing stood in his way. The Vatican had even become the first state to recognize his odious regime, giving it tacit approval by its Reich Concordat. So the Church, the papacy in particular, was heavily involved in this rise of Hitler to power. Then we come to the Holocaust. And it's interesting what is written here, what some of the evidence is that John Cornwell brought out. Again, there is no account in the 6-year period of World War II in Europe from 1939 to 1945, where the Pope condemns what was being done to the Jews. Now, it only became obvious to most of the world in 1942 that the Jews were being exterminated. It had started earlier than that, but it wasn't until 1942 that word actually got out and there was evidence of what was taking place. London, Washington, and Moscow all condemned what was taking place. The ambassadors of Britain and the United States both asked the Pope to join them in their condemnation, to endorse their statement condemning the extermination of the Jews. And he refused. He did not want to get involved. But it's interesting how in the book John Cornwall also traces anti-Semitism in the church. He goes right back to the First Council of Nicaea in 325. At the First Council of Nicaea in 325, the Emperor Constantine ordained that Easter should not compete with the Jewish Passover. It is unbecoming, he declared, that on the holiest of festivals we should follow the customs of the Jews. Henceforth, let us have nothing in common with this odious people. That was the Emperor Constantine's writing in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. And, you know, that anti-Semitic feeling has come down through the centuries, perpetuated not just by the church, I mean the people as well, but, you know, the church has continued it in many ways, because the church has taught that the Jews killed Christ. Christian antipathy toward the Jews was born out of the belief dating from the early Christian church that the Jews had murdered Christ. Indeed, that they had murdered God. The early fathers of the church, the great Christian writers of the first 6 centuries of Christianity, showed striking evidence of anti-Judaism. The blood of Jesus, wrote Origen, falls not only on the Jews of that time, but on all generations of Jews up to the end of the world. St. John Chrysostom wrote, "The synagogue is a brothel, a hiding place for unclean beasts. Never has any Jew prayed to God. They are possessed by demons." This is the kind of sentiment that's been passed down. Persecution became the norm for the Jews in Christian countries throughout the centuries that followed. The Holocaust is the persecution that resulted in the most deaths in the shortest possible time, but it was just one of many periods of intense persecution of Jews by Christians. Now, John Cornwall, the writer of the book Hitler's Pope, wrote an article in the London Sunday Times and said this: "Pacelli's failure to defend the Jews cannot be seen in isolation from the development of the ideology of papal authority. From the very outset of his career, he had associated Judaism with the Bolshevist communist threat to destroy Christianity. Karl Marx was a Jew. Friedrich Engels was a Jew. And they were the main minds behind communism. And many of the Russian leaders, when the communists took over in 1917, were Jews. Trotsky, the leader of the Red Army, was a Jew. So to Hitler and to Eugenio Pacelli, the Pope, communism and Judaism were the same. So their hatred of communism extended to the hatred of the Jews, and the hatred of the Jews, of course, influenced their attitude towards communism. His antipathy to Jews, though, it says, went much deeper. Writing in 1919, a long time before the Second World War, to a Vatican official from Munich, which had become the center of local Bolshevik agitation, Pacelli had described the revolutionaries and their chief, Eugen Levin, in his headquarters in the former Royal Palace. In the city of Munich, communists took power after World War I, temporarily. And Pacelli was there, and this is what he wrote. "The building, once the home of a king, where these revolutionaries had taken over, resounded with screams, vile language, profanities. In the midst of all this, a gang of young women of dubious appearance, Jews like all the rest of them, hanging around in all the offices with lecherous demeanor and suggestive smiles. The boss of this female rabble was Levine's mistress, a young Russian woman, a Jew, and a divorcee who was in charge. This Levine is also Russian and a Jew, pale, dirty, with vacant eyes, hoarse voice, vulgar, repulsive, with a face that is both intelligent and sly." Just one example of his anti-Semitism. Like many, including Hitler, Pacelli equated communism with the Jews. There's a couple of other extracts from the book I want to read to you, because some of it is rather sad. During the Holocaust, when all this pressure was being put upon him, in 1942 it became obvious to the world that the Jews were being exterminated. And knowing how much influence the Pope had, and that if he stood up and condemned it, the Germans might back off, because half the German people were Catholics, and they couldn't risk a clash with the Vatican, pressure was put on the Pope by some of the leaders of the Western world.
to do something, to say something in his Christmas broadcast. On December 24th, 1942, having made draft after draft, Pius XII broadcast his Christmas message to the world. His theme was the rights of man and the problems of the individual in relation to the state. He began by asserting that an imbalance between the state and the individual had been brought about by the damaging economic policies of recent decades, in which everything had become subordinated to the profit motive, an attack on the Western world. This had led to the reduction of the individual to the utility of the state, to the exclusion of all ethical and religious considerations. No discrimination, no insight is to be found in the sermon on the contrast between totalitarianism and democracy, social democracy and communism, capitalism and welfare capitalism. Just didn't get involved. From his papal overview, he declared that what the world lacked was the peaceful ordering of society offered by allegiance to Holy Mother Church. If only the church was in control of the whole world, everything would be perfect. Pacelli's concept of an ideal society, however, beyond appeals to individual and family piety, was a hybrid of corporatist nostrums and appeals to responsible Christian spirit. Underpinning everything was the premise of papal supremacy. If only the Pope was in charge of the world, everything would be perfect. Following this lengthy and dry sermonizing on Catholic social doctrine, he came at last to the atrocities of war, the moment the world beyond Nazi Europe had been waiting for. The war, he said, was the result of a social order that concealed a fatal weakness and an unbridled lust for profit and power. He then talked in general terms, pleading for a vow to be made by men of goodwill to bring society back to its immovable center of gravity in divine law under the Church. Humanity owes this vow, he now said, to those innumerable exiles whom the hurricane of war has torn away from their native soil and dispersed in a foreign land. Then came the famous statement, intended, he later claimed, to be understood as a clear denunciation of the Nazi extermination of the Jewish people. This, then, he claimed, was his condemnation of the Holocaust. Humanity owes this vow to those hundreds of thousands who, without any fault of their own, sometimes only by reason of their nationality or race, are marked down for death or gradual extinction. Nothing is said of Jews or Nazis, not even mentioned. It's a statement that could be made about anything. And yet, later on he claimed that it was a condemnation. Of course, he only claimed that after World War II was over. In fact, in 1946, when delegates of the Supreme Council of the Arab People of Palestine, over 1 year after World War II, visited Rome. This is what Pacelli said, Pius XII. It is superfluous for me to tell you that we disapprove of all recourse to force and violence, from wherever it comes, just as we condemned on various occasions in the past the persecutions that a fanatical anti-Semitism inflicted on the Hebrew people. You know, once the war was over and he knew who had won, then he claimed that he had been attacking the Nazis for killing all the Jews. But during the war, he never said a thing. It's rather interesting that the German ambassador to the Vatican at this time, at the end of World War II, was sympathetic to the Jews. And he was trying to get the Pope to speak out so that the Jews in Italy, at least, would be saved. But the Pope still wouldn't. So finally, the ambassador sent a message back to Hitler telling Hitler that the Pope was upset about all of this and was condemning what was going on. You know, the ambassador did that to his own country, to his own leader, Hitler. And so Hitler kind of backed off a little bit and didn't round up as many. They let quite a few go. So the ambassador had more guts than the Pope did. The Pope did nothing to help these people. There's a couple of harrowing accounts of, here it says, the trucks, finally, you know, Mussolini, the Italians, change sides. They do that quite often. Italy, you can't. Some of these countries in Europe, you cannot rely upon them. The French and the Italians in particular, they're always changing sides. You know what they say about Italian tanks? They come with four reverse gears and one forward gear just in case they get attacked from the rear. Anyway, meanwhile, the trucks, the Nazis then, the Germans came in and took Rome because the Italians changed sides. So the Germans arrived and they took the city of Rome and they started rounding up the Jews. The trucks filled with men, women, and children were finding their way through the heavy downpour, many with difficulty, to the bleak barracks of the Collegio Militare. They were gathering all the Jews in one place. Some trucks, this is unbelievable, some trucks
past the boundary of St. Peter's Square, deliberately driven by that route, so that the SS soldiers who had been drafted into Rome for the roundup could catch a glimpse of the famous church. So they were rounding up Jews, and they took them past the church just to get a glimpse of the world's biggest church, St. Peter's Basilica. The Jews, it has also been said, called out as they passed the Vatican. They called out for the Pope to help them as they passed along the perimeter of the square. By the way, none of these Jews, 1 week later, were still alive. They survived 5 days because they were just taken off and gassed, all of them, that were rounded up. So they were screaming out to the Pope for help. Eyewitness accounts are full of pathos. An Italian journalist reported the eyes of the children were dilated and unseeing. It seemed as if they were asking for an explanation for such terror and suffering. In one street, 3 trucks with an exceptionally large number of children had come to a halt. The Marquise de Miana, an aristocrat, passed through the street. I saw in their terror-stricken eyes, in the faces grown pale as if with pain, and in their little quivering hands that clung to the sides of the truck, the maddening fear that had overtaken them. The scenes enacted that morning had been repeated countless times and in countless places throughout Europe in the previous 2 years. The difference was that in this city there was a man with a powerful voice who commanded the allegiance of 500 million human beings and whose capacity to protest could give even Hitler serious pause for thought. According to Weizsäcker, the German ambassador to the Holy See, on that morning, pressure from all sides was building, calling for a demonstrative papal censure of the deportation of the Jews of Rome. Much of that pressure was coming from the German authorities, notably the German consul in Rome, Albrecht von Kessel. Kessel urged Pacelli that day to make an official protest. The fear of the German leadership in Rome was that a deportation would spell a violent reaction from the Italian populace. And so they wanted the Pope to protest. So the Germans there, the German leadership that had taken Rome, was actually asking him to condemn the deportation of the Jews because they feared the reaction of the people. But the Pope still did not do it. And it was because of his own anti-Semitism. I think it helps you to see, though, how in the past we've had periods where the Church has persecuted the true people of God. How you've had, like, the time after the Council of Nicaea, when anybody found keeping the Sabbath and the holy days was put to death. And we've had these regular periods throughout history. And the book of Revelation says that we have one more still ahead. There are 7 kings, 5 have fallen, 1 is. The other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. So we're going to see this happen again. And interestingly, it's taken 55 years for confirmation of the Church's role in the Second World War, in the 6th resurrection of the Roman Empire, in the First and Second World War. It's taken all this time to prove a Church-State connection. It may be that when the state comes together again, when the final resurrection of the Roman Empire comes together again, we may not see clearly the Church's role in it at the beginning. It may be something that in hindsight we will be able to see, just as we have been able to now with the last 2 world wars. Look at a few other scriptures. Revelation 13. I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Again, these resurrections of the Roman Empire, and on his horns, 10 crowns, and on his head, the blasphemous name. Vicar of Christ is a blasphemous title, because nobody can stand in the place of Jesus Christ. Now, the beast which I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. This is the combination, if you like, of all the previous empires before the Roman Empire. The dragon, Satan, gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. The Roman Empire was destroyed in 476, but then it was healed, and you know, it came back together again, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. That period of time in history, from Justinian till Napoleon, where the Church dominated everything. But then there's another time coming of a literal 42 months during the tribulation. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. In verse 15, talking of this false religious system, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. The church is the image of the beast. In fact, history shows the church actually continued the Roman Empire. After the physical empire collapsed, the church picked up the pieces and just carried on running everything similar to the way the empire had run everything. Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. Now, we live in a period now where the church doesn't have that power. So it's a wonderful time to live because we have the freedom that people have been denied for centuries. But again, we do see that this is coming back, because with the decline of the English-speaking countries, the Protestant nations, and the ascendancy of the Gentile nations, you know, this system is going to come back with great power and authority again. Daniel 7 is an overview of history. Verse 8, it says, I was considering the horns. There was another horn, a little one, coming up among them. This is talking of the papacy, this little horn. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. And it's talking specifically there about the papacy and its rise to preeminence during this period of Roman domination. We go further down. In verse 19, Daniel writes, I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. And about the ten horns that were on its head, and about the other horn which came up, before whom three horns fell. So again, this papacy, that the church, when the Roman Empire was destroyed in 476, there were various attempts by, you know, Germanic tribes, warlike tribes. The word German means war people. So these warlike tribes came in to Rome and tried to kind of take over the administration of Rome, but, you know, they were just anarchic, basically. And the church was not involved in those. But then those three attempts there, those three different periods of rule in the 5th and 6th centuries, came to an end, and then the church and the state came together. And the church then was to dominate the next seven resurrections of the Roman Empire. And go further down. It says, the fourth beast in verse 23 shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces, the Roman Empire. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first one, and shall subdue three kings. Talking again about this false religious system and the papacy. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, proclaiming himself as the vicar of Christ, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and laws, changing the Sabbath to Sunday, changing the holy days, and introducing Easter instead of the Passover, and even ensuring that Easter can never fall on the same days as the Passover, so that people who keep the Passover can easily be identified and put to death. That was the intention of the Council of Nicaea. Then the saints, the true believers, shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time, about 42 months. A day for a year, it's the period 1260 years from the time of Justinian right through to Napoleon's time, after which the domination of the British Empire and then later on the United States ensured the religious freedom that we enjoy today. But it wasn't there before. And sometimes we can so casually just assume it's going to be there forever. But that is not what Bible prophecy shows us. But we see there these prophecies regarding this false church. In verse 25, I think it's, I can find it there. Oh, it's a different translation here, but in one translation it talks about this false church shall wear out the saints of the Most High. Just wear them out. And that's happening even now to people in God's church. It's not a case of persecution so much today, but it's just that the whole world we live in is so geared to this false religion that people get worn out. People get worn out trying to, you know, fight, you know, in quotes, against the trends in society and the pressures from society to conform. And so we see people increasingly compromising, and you know, even the fracturing in the church, we've seen some of that too, where people compromised by absorbing some of the false religion into their own little groups, some of these groups that have gone off. They just absorb some aspects of Protestantism and various other aspects of this false religion. So they're kind of compromising with it. People are just worn out. So again, we do need to pray very fervently for Christ's return. Hitler's Pope is a remarkable book which fills in a gap in our understanding of the fulfillment of prophecy. It's always been easy to see the role of the church in the first five resurrections of the Roman Empire, but the sixth one proved elusive, but not anymore. This would also confirm that to be consistent with prophecy about seven resurrections, that the next one will also see heavy church involvement, that it might be behind the scenes, because now we can see all six of the previous resurrections of the empire, the church was heavily involved. So I don't think there can be any doubt that the seventh one will also see church involvement, perhaps once again behind the scenes, unreported, as it was in the sixth.